That's why they're resurrecting the cultures that taught the mystery schools, right? They start teaching people Greek, Roman. They start bringing the classics back into education, because for a while in Europe, the Bible was all people were taught, unless you were, you know, of a certain class and status and you had access to a library. For the most part, unless you were Jewish, if you were Christian, you just had the New Testament to read. That was your sort, your reading material, if you even knew how to read.
Welcome back to Occult Symbolism and Pop Culture. Today we're joined by a very special guest. First time guest, we've got Mystic Mark. That's right. You know him. You love him. We're going to talk about how he met the great Sam Tripoli. We're going to talk about some of his inspirations for podcasting. I'm going to drop some good tips in there. If you're a beginning podcaster, take a listen to what we got to say. You know, I've been doing this a long time. He's been doing it a long time. Then we're going to get into the esoteric concepts. We're going to talk about the Kybalion. We're going to talk about simulation theory, how the news is creating the new simulation theory. We'll talk about his podcasts, My Family Thinks I'm Crazy, and its origin story, as well as Esoteric America, which includes several topics. We'll talk about New England Stonehenge, some theories about rocks and stones, and then we're going to go deep into New Haven and the Skull of Bones of Yale. We're going to talk about the origin of this group, Geronimo's Skull, the Bush family, Rosicrucians, the founding fathers of America with the Revolutionary War, Native Americans, Mormonism, who is in the Illuminati. And then, of course, I'm going to hit them with the five questions at the end. So if you want to get more from Mystic Mark, be sure to check out his website, myfamilythinksimcrazy.com. I have the links in the show notes. That'll give you the jump offs to all of his podcasts. Let's get into it. All right, everybody, we're joined by a very special guest today. We've got the man, the myth, legend. I consider you one of the hardest working men in the podcast business. You're up there with Sam Tripoli, man. And it makes sense because you're one of the swarm. So I'm pleased to introduce Mystic Mark to Occult Symbolism Pop Culture. How you doing, Mark?
Hey, thanks for having me, Isaac. It's a pleasure to be here. I've been listening to your show for a long time. And that means a lot coming from you because you're up there on Sam's Mount Rushmore of top guests. So
yeah, that's a
thank
big,
you.
Oh yeah. No, pleasure's all mine, man. That's a lot of people, I wanted to kind of take a few minutes. Let's catch up the audience with who you are in case they're not familiar with your work. And then we'll talk a little bit about each of your podcasts to let everybody know kind of the flavor of what each one does and talks about. And then the bulk of the show, I'd like to talk to you about Skull and Bones. You know, you told me you were doing some deep diving into it. So, and it's a subject I'm not very well versed in. You know, a lot of these conspiracy topics, you could devote a whole lifetime researching some of these topics. And I'm not that familiar with the depths of Skull and Bone. So let's catch up here. Mystic Mark, you've been, you know, and I was introduced to you through Tinfoil Hat, right? You're the booker.
Yep.
Is that the right term?
I think that was the first time we were in touch. Yeah, I booked you on Sam's show, and you had been on Sam's show, you know, before I came into the picture. But I always respected your work and thought, oh, you know, we got to get Isaac on and back on and back on. I've been responsible for, I don't know, you maybe breaking the record for most returning spots, because I love when you're on the show. I think you do a great job, and you work with Sam's energy well. So yeah, that's when we first met, and Sam and I met at a show in New York City. I gave him a copy of a book called The Kybalion, which to me is an important book. I think everybody should read it just to understand, you know, what's going on with Western philosophy and esotericism, because these are sort of foundational ideas in Western esotericism. And Sam, you know, he was kind of aware, but mostly new to that whole world. And I think for him, it was like a key opening a door. And that year that I gave him that book, a lot of things changed in his life. He started doing more podcasts. And around that same time he started doing more podcasts, he needed a guy like me to, you know, arrange his podcast schedule, because when you're doing four or five podcasts, you can't, you know, and stand-up comedy and all these other things, he just doesn't have the time to juggle that. So I love it because I'm a huge fan of that show, and you know, I love being able to like figure out which topics and which guests are going to be good for the show. And then sometimes I'm right, sometimes I'm catastrophically wrong. But that's why I love having my own podcast. My family thinks I'm crazy because that, you know, I'm able to do whatever I want on that show. And it's thanks to Sam that show even really became a reality. Because I remember when I went home to my family and I said, I'm working for Sam Tripoli. This is great. He's this guy from LA. And they looked at me like, are you what? You know, and that's when the name came to me. My family thinks I'm crazy, you know, right around that same time, because they'd always thought I was crazy, but it just like hit me like a sack of bricks when I told them that I was working for Sam, because they had no clue who he was, were not excited for me at all. But I was on cloud nine. I could care less what they thought. I was like, this is great. I've been listening to this guy for 5 years and now I'm working for him. What's my luck? So yeah.
Wow, that's crazy. You were listening for that long, huh?
I've been a big fan, I mean, of podcasts. You know, when I was first starting in this realm, I was just a delivery guy listening to podcasts every day listening. So that's probably why my show sounds the way it does, because, you know, this is like a labor of love for me. I love podcasts. So to make one was a big endeavor, and I put a lot of thought into it. But yeah, listening to Sam's, you know, shows like Sam's show, Tinfoil Hat, The Higher Side Chats, The Grimerica Show, those three were big for me. And, you know, one thing led to another. I just started my own, you know. It's sort of funny how it happened.
You know, that's something I've noticed, because when I've talked to several people, I'm not saying I'm a consultant, but I've had several people who are either thinking about launching a podcast or recently launched a podcast, looking for some feedback. And I'm no expert. I happened to like stumble into this thing, and I just happened to have started long ago, near the beginning of it, kind of. And one thing, if you look at the stats, I think it's something like 80 or 90% of podcasts don't make it past the first year. And I think that's because there's actually a fair amount of work. I think when you go to launch a podcast, you think, oh, I've got some ideas I want to share with the world. Let me do that. And either you do it on your own like I do, or you have guests on, which I sometimes do. But it's hard to book guests. Everyone's schedules are and you know, in the podcasting world, a lot of people don't know this, but you don't get paid to do guest appearances. So if I would book a guest, because I started out trying to do the guest thing, I tried to go that route, but I work a day job and then I have this, you know, podcast and books and crap. And I'm sure you're familiar with this struggle, but a lot of guests, they'll book, and then, you know, I would book the guest and I would come home from work that day. I would take some time off work, come home, get all set up, and then they would write me, hey man, I can't make it for whatever reason. Cause you know, there's no money in it. So it's a very low priority for a lot of people, especially when you're starting out, when you don't have a big audience.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely helps to have people on who have an incentive to be there, you know, cause you're absolutely right. There are people who I've tried to have on who, you know, they're totally okay with ghosting you four times in a row. And it's like, hey man, like what world do you live in where that's okay? But to your point, you know, I'm not paying them, so they're a free human being. They could ditch me if they want to, and I don't really mind, because there's so many other brilliant people that do have an incentive to go on podcasts, whether they're selling something like a book. You know, that's usually the best case scenario when someone's selling something, is that it's a book and not like, you know, some kind of crazy, I don't want to throw shade on anybody, but you know what I mean, like dietary pills or something, some crap you just don't need, because there are folks like that who want to, you know, use podcasting to hawk those products. But for the most part, you got a point, but I think the curve has crested a bit, because like you're an OG, you've been doing this for at least 4 or 5 years. I imagine when you started it was harder to book podcast guests than it is now, because podcasts are more a part of the, you know, modern zeitgeist. Now people who are, I don't know, boomers know what podcasts are, right? So it's definitely a little bit easier to have people on your show. I mean, I book so many people. For me, it's like, it's never really hard. But then again, I don't get attached to one person. Like, if someone says no to me, I'm on to the next one. You know, that's one for anyone who cares. You know, if you're thinking about starting a podcast, maybe that's some good advice. Don't be so attached to one person. Cause yeah, you're going to have people say no. And if you invested, you know, all your hopes into having David Icke on your podcast, and all of a sudden David Icke's, you're writing another book and has no time for you, like, you know, kick rocks and find someone else.
Right. Yeah. I tried to get him on my show many, I got really close a couple times and I couldn't reel him in, you know, but that's the idea of loving, like you said, when you started out, you enjoyed consuming podcasts. That's where I was. I started listening to podcasts in about, I don't know, 2010 or so. And then I started my blog that year. And it was funny because I was blogging and my wife was talking to me and she said, why don't you start a YouTube channel and just kind of regurgitate what your blog article says onto a YouTube video and throw some images up. And I said, okay. And it was terrible at the beginning. It was absolutely like low energy, no charisma, but you know, you got to start somewhere. And that flipped into, well, let me take the audio and put it on a podcast feed. Back in 2014, I started doing that, but I didn't take it seriously. I didn't take it seriously until YouTube and Google banned me. And then that was in about 2015 and 16 that happened. And that's when I said, well, this is about all I got left is podcasts, as far as reaching out with weekly ideas. You know, I was writing books, of course, the whole time. But
excuse me for saying 5 years before. You've been doing this for almost 9 years. Damn,
yeah, a long time. Decade. Yeah, a long time. And at the beginning, I was only doing maybe one show a month or so. And I had a few voices of people saying, hey, I wish you would do more podcasts. And I get it, you know, because I listen to podcasts, but I didn't like it. I didn't like it's more performative. And I didn't like that. I just like researching and writing, and leave me out of it. But
that may be where you and I are a little different, because for whatever reason, you know, I don't know if it's God made me this way or what, but I've always had a big mouth for big ideas.
Yeah.
And like, I love talking about this kind of stuff with my friends, and Ancient Aliens was probably a show that did it to me big time, because I would watch that show and I would run to my friends and be like, did you see they got this and they got this? And none of my friends believed in aliens. So it was always like a challenge, like, okay, what did I see this time that I can, and I'm talking high school now, but that was a big kind of cue into this world for me, because I was always trying to like have these conversations with people who for the most part didn't really care. Now it's a lot easier because I can phone up a guy like you and I can talk about this kind of stuff, and there's generally no resistance because you're into this stuff too. And the same is true for a lot of my guests, but I had to build up a lot of zeal for these topics when I was younger, because I had a lot of like pushback, a lot of people who were like, oh, you're wasting your time, or, you know, don't you want to like watch the baseball game or something? And I was more interested in reading like Zachariah Sitchin and Carl Sagan, and then stumbling through New Haven and learning that there's this whole international secret society at Yale University. I mean, that was all before I listened to podcasts. I really had no idea what to make of it. You know, I found a few books, but that was like the big red flag, I guess.
Well, that's, and I want to ask you about your background, as far as, I don't want to say a belief system. And of course, this is a no judgment zone. I'm cool with whatever people want to believe. I always say it. I say, you know, if people want to worship Satan, I don't care. Don't bother me none. That's your prerogative. But you talk about giving Sam the Kybalion book. I haven't read the whole book. I watched the Mitch Horowitz did a documentary about it. I think it's called The Kybalion.
Yeah.
And I watched it, and I recall it being a lot of, like you said, it's like hermetic wisdom, alchemy type ideas, as above, so below, law of correspondence. Is that ring true? Is that kind of what the ideas are behind it?
Yeah, it's essentially, you know, seven laws, the first one being all is mind. So the first law is that mind is all and all is mind. And, you know, take or leave the other six. I think that one was the big reason why I wanted to give Sam the Kybalion was because he was talking a lot about the simulation theory at that point in time. And what really struck me, well, the idea I wanted to get across to him was like, hey, simulation theory is not new at all. People in ancient times were thinking like this. They just didn't have a computer to use as analogy, so they called it a mind. That's all they had. All they had was their mind. They didn't have computers, so they used them. That was the analogy. Oh, we live in a giant mind. Just like today, people are saying, oh, we live in a giant computer. We're living in a computer-simulated reality. So when I started hearing him say that, I thought, I think Sam should check out the Kybalion, because this is a more organic, this is more human. This is a human way of interacting with this knowledge rather than allegorifying it and artificizing it. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with that. A computer is a great metaphor, but, you know, you asked me about my beliefs. I believe in God. I believe in a creator. I believe in nature being regenerative and healing and a part of what humans are supposed to experience. So when I see computer simulations being like the, you know, main entry point into understanding our world, it gets me a little concerned, because, you know, I come from the school of thought that like nature is the greatest guide, and the natural world is our greatest guide, not a man-made object. Now, a computer kind of supersedes the definition of man-made object. I mean, you know, it's a very complicated device that can connect you with millions of people. I think that's beautiful. But we do have to be careful not to live our lives, you know, in a computer-simulated realm, like thinking that that's actually what we're a part of. I can't prove that we are or aren't, you know, on a philosophical level. I can't prove whether we are or aren't. But personally, I think it's a dangerous way to understand your world. It's, you know, to use like a relatively new device as a metaphor for what we live in. You know, I mean, computers are relatively new compared to Mother Nature, right? So I don't know, maybe they've been invented thousands of times throughout the millennia, but I do think that the Kybalion is kind of like an ancient, more natural understanding of the world. And I think religions over time have integrated these thoughts from the Kybalion into Christianity, into Buddhism, into Hinduism. You see these ideas sort of woven into those as well, because, you know, there's this sort of diffusionism idea with Western esotericism and Western philosophy that things all come from one original source. And that may be, you know, I don't know enough to prove that wrong. So as far as the Kybalion goes, I don't have like a religious perspective that says like the Kybalion's better than this or anything like that. You know, I don't think of the Kybalion as like my Bible or something like that. But if I were to collect a few like spiritual books, the Kybalion would be on the list. Probably the Tao Te Ching would be the first one, because for me personally, on my personal journey, the Tao Te Ching was the first religious book that I read that actually connected with me. When I was in church as a Roman Catholic, you know, my family's Roman Catholic, I was exposed to the Bible, the Old and the New Testament, and I have no strong sympathies for that. I don't have a big attachment to that, but I am curious, and I'm always like sort of trying to, especially now with the New Haven and Skull and Bones research, I'm really trying to wrap my head around Christianity more and more and more and figure it out and understand it. Whereas when I was a kid and I was sitting in the pew and kneeling on the bench, I was like, this sucks. I hate this, you know, and right. I just totally like pushed all that out of my mind. But now it's actually interesting, and I'm curious to go back and like see, you know, what I was being bored to sleep with.
Yeah, I have the same experience as a child. I hated church. I couldn't get out of there fast enough. And we went to church often. We had to go Sunday morning, Sunday night, and then Wednesday night.
Oh,
I was just so over it. And
you're Greek Orthodox, right?
Well, I am now. I grew up in a Church of the Nazarene, Charles Manson's church.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Ironically. And Yeah, we just went all the time. And, you know, I couldn't get along with anyone I went to church with because I seemed to be the only one that had interest in things I wasn't supposed to be interested in. And people really, you know, they felt the presence of God in their life and I didn't. And I just, I hated church. I wanted to get out of there all the time. And then as an adult, I met my wife and she's not a very, like a super fervent religious person, but she grew up Greek Orthodox, baptized, and she introduced me to that faith. And that, and maybe it could be a mixture of that faith or my age, but I became more interested in it from a more mystical kind of perspective, because when you're a kid, it's just, yeah, you're like, I just want to go play with my toys. I don't want to sit here and do prayers and all this stuff. But as an adult, and look, I'm not a good Christian. I couldn't tell you the last time I've been to church, but I took it seriously for a few years. I was going to every service, we had every book club. So it's not like I never took it seriously. I just, I don't know. I just, for a variety of excuses, I don't go that much anymore. But that's interesting that you mentioned the, and I want to get into your skull and bone stuff because I'm looking at the clock. But the simulation theory is interesting that you say it's actually an older idea. I was just listening to a podcast. I was getting the name of it and I'll be damned if I already forgot. It's called Strange History. And they have little short episodes and they have one about conspiracies. And I believe she was saying that it goes all the way back to Plato's cave, right? The idea of the allegory of the cave and the simulation and stuff. So
yeah, you could consider that like an early iteration of the simulation theory for sure. Yeah. 'Cause they're looking at their own shadows and being told that that's all the world is, like what's under you, what you can see around you and what you see on the wall. That's all there is. And I think the whole point is that, you know, Plato or whomever figures out, oh no, we're in a cave right now. These shadows aren't real. Like that's the idea, is to figure that out and break that hold that your perspective can have over you. I mean, that's essentially what they're talking about. And you can simulate reality using just that, using perspective. I mean, that's what the media does to us right now. For you and I, there might not be a war going on, but for a lot of Americans right now who spend, you know, their time watching, you know, MSNBC or whatever else, Fox, whatever else, they think there's a war going on, and there might be, you know, but for the most part, I think you and I are a little more skeptical about what we see on television. But yeah, that, I think perspective management has been going on since the time of ancient Greece and Rome, and certainly going on today in the mainstream.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic. It's oh man, I don't want to get down in this rabbit hole, but yeah, it's like all the billionaires owning all the news. And then even David Icke, his early work before I was familiar with simulation theory and stuff like that, he was talking about the mind as a projector and all this. Anyway, fascinating topic. Let's briefly go over your podcast for people who aren't familiar with your podcast. You've got My Family Thinks I'm Crazy, which you've been knocking out some real bangers. You interview guests. You've had recently Joseph Farrell, Crow 777, Chris Knowles, Nick Hinton, Richard Spence, Michael Hoffman, and of course the great Sam Tripoli. You got any other huge names you want to drop that you've either had on or you got coming on to the show? That's an impressive Rolodex already.
You just named some episodes that I'm very proud of. Yeah, I was real pleasure to talk to Dr. Joseph Farrell. You know, he's got 30 something books all on these topics that you and I love. So
he's one of the OGs of when I was early, like you were talking about, early in my days before I even started blogging, listening to podcasts, and he would be on talking about all this crazy stuff.
It was challenging because, you know, he's written so many books. It's like, what do I interview him about? And I ended up talking to him about the Templars and a few other things, but yeah, hopefully Walter Bosley will be the next person on the list. He's sort of friends with Dr. Farrell, so that hopefully will help us slip into his DMs, so to speak. So we'll see what happens next. But yeah, no, I'm kind of tapped out right now. I just put in so much like really good interviews that I'm like just gonna ride off of those for a few weeks and then plan a few more, you know, after I get a little break. But yeah, I have my family thinks I'm crazy. Obviously, I work for Tinfoil Hat, but there are other podcasts that I produce, create, and host on. One of them is called Esoteric America, which we'll be talking a little bit about today. Esoteric America was sort of an idea that my girlfriend and I had. Essentially, the show takes place wherever our guest is. And we've had a bunch of different guests on, and they tell us about where they're from. So we've talked about Anderson, Indiana, Baudette, Minnesota, Inland Empire, California, just to name a few random places. And then we've talked about places that people are super familiar with, like Austin, Texas, or Nashville, Tennessee. And, you know, every time we go into one of these virtual tours, virtual journey, we're looking for, you know, lost artifacts, esoteric history, cryptids, you know, weird ghost stories. So it's really like a hodgepodge each episode of different things. And the only real connection is the place. So that's kind of the thought, is like, let's go and look around in America and find these little weird areas. You know, there's some really cool podcasts that kind of inspired it, I guess. Pennyroyal would be one of them, and their exploration of Somerset, Kentucky, and all the weird stuff going on in Somerset, Kentucky with the Mammoth Caves, and they got these goblin people running around and meat falling from the sky, and, you know, just so many things that make your head, you scratch your head. And I thought, well, there's got to be loads of places like this out there. I've got tons of books, Strange America this, Weird America that. So that's what we're doing. We're just trying to, you know, think of it like a travel guide, but in podcast form.
Have you read Peter Lavenda's Sinister Forces books?
Yeah, Peter Lavenda's on my shelf. I can't say I finished that series, but I have started the Sinister Forces, the first book I've read. And yeah, it gets into some really, really connected territory, at least to what we're talking about next. A little foreshadowing.
I think that first book goes into some of those Kentucky. Man, I can't think of the name of the caves. There's like a cave system out there, all kinds of stuff. Yeah, that might be it. Okay, so Esoteric America. I wanted to ask you, because you live up in the northeast there. Have you done a show, an episode on New Hampshire, the Stonehenge? What do you call it, America Stonehenge yet? Have you done that one yet?
Well, I've talked about that. Part of my research into my local area has involved stones and the stone structures. Because for people who have been to New England before, they may have seen these stone walls. They're everywhere. They're in people's front yards. They're in state parks. They go up the sides of mountains. They go into rivers, crossing rivers. So they're everywhere. And I started to look at these things and say, they look a lot older than we're told. We're told that farmers built these stone walls 400 or 500 years ago. Even Stonehenge in New Hampshire, They have no official explanation for who built it, other than, oh, must have been the Native Americans, because that's the only people we knew were here. Well, that doesn't really add up, you know? I mean, especially when you look at some of the newer information coming out about how the Native Americans that were in New England actually migrated from the West only less than 1,000 years before the English came and settled. So it brings in a lot of questions on who could have built these stone structures around New England. And for a long time, I thought it must be the Native Americans, because the people who wrote about them were racist and just didn't want to give them any credit for anything advanced. And that's a fine idea. And it may be true. And it may be true in some places. But I started to find more and more evidence that there were Vikings and Celts here in America before Columbus. And I'm not suggesting that Native Americans are white or were Celts or you know, Scottish or something like that, or even Scandinavian. But we have to start looking at history differently, because what happened in North America before Columbus was like this melting pot that we're told happened after Columbus. And it really happened before Columbus, because you have the Celt Iberians, you have the Phoenicians, you have the Scandinavians, and then you have all of the different groups of Native Americans. And there's a bunch of different groups, and some of them are completely gone because of diseases. And there are groups of people like the Mound Builders who clearly had some pretty advanced culture. They were able to pull off those, you know, mound constructions. But what I find even more fascinating are the stone structures. We're talking about stones, some of them 60 tons, and they're propped up on boulders that are like 200 pounds, like minuscule compared to the boulder it's holding up. And you have to ask yourself, how do men take a 60-pound boulder, lift it 5 feet in the air, and then perch it on top of these much smaller boulders, right? And right. Scientists, they say, no, that's a glacier. The glacier moved these stones. And I'm telling you, Isaac, if you went out and looked at some of these stone structures, you'd be like, there's no way a glacier placed this way. Like, the glaciers don't lay stones in a masonry type of way. They don't position stones according to north, south, east, west, right? Right, right. A glacier does things randomly. A glacier does things chaotically. It doesn't bring order to the landscape. And what we see all across New England is this ordered landscape. And that's Stonehenge in New Hampshire is a great example of it, but there are better examples. And I think they actually show people American Stonehenge almost as if to be like, yep, that's the tip of the iceberg. Don't worry about it.
Oh, interesting.
Because American Stonehenge, it's great and all, but it has a better story than some of the others. Like some of the other stone structures, you just can't explain.
Interesting.
Whereas American Stonehenge makes a little bit more sense, right? Because people can pull off something like Stonehenge just using their own observations, right? Mm-hmm. You can see where the planets are, the sun is, and you can create something on the ground to sort of match their paths. But there are boulders that are massive that have those same alignments. And we're told that these Native Americans only had bows and arrows and stone spears. Like they didn't even have shovels, but they were able to move these huge boulders.
Right.
Something doesn't add up. And that's why I really enjoyed this journey into esoteric America, because there's so much that's been hidden. You know, we've been given this like storybook version of our history. You know, we're told about George Washington and the cherry tree and Benjamin Franklin and the kite. And, you know, we don't learn about Crispus Attucks, who was the first person to die in the American Revolutionary War, who was a Native American and a black man. He was half black, half Native American. And he was actually the first guy that died in the Boston Massacre because he was ready to go. He was ready to fight, you know. Nobody gives him credit, right? Because, you know, obviously the racism stuff, but it's more than that. It's not just racism. I almost feel like racism is a way for them to, you know, keep people uninterested in getting into this history, you know, because it's an extremist thing. Oh, the racists care about hidden history because they're all trying to prove that the white man is the best. It has nothing to do with that. In fact, it's probably the opposite, where academia has had these biases and racist views, and they've left things out of history that show that history is a lot more diverse, and people of all different walks of life, creeds, and colors have contributed to this great American, you know, experiment. Really, it's an experiment, and they want you to think that it's only been, you know, crafted by the hands of George Washington and Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, but there's so many minds that have gone into it. I mean, me looking into my own backyard's history, New Haven, Connecticut, and New England, you know, I found so much information that contradicts what we were taught in school. And that's why this show, Esoteric America, is such a great idea, because I'm not just putting all the pressure on myself to figure all this out. I'm inviting people who like the show to be on the show to tell us about where they live. You know, and kind of keep the ball rolling forward, because I'm only one person. My girlfriend Roman and Chad and I, you know, we're just four people. We can't uncover every, you know, secret in America, but we want to get people, you know, a part of it, have people participate in the show. And that way we can sort of crowdsource this, because there's people listening who go out and do their own research, and I figure why not give them an opportunity to share it.
Right. That's, and I talked to you about this when you first launched. I want to get on the show. I actually have two interesting locations, because I live in Utah now. I've lived here for maybe 20 years now, which is, I mean, chocked full of esoteric occult symbolism with the LDS and their Freemasonic roots. But and there's a lot going on in Utah. I mean, from northern Utah to southern Utah, there's so much. But then I actually grew up in Lancaster, PA is where I grew up, and in a small town called Ephrata, PA, which is where the cloisters were. And if you get into the occult history of America, it boils down to right there, because the Rosicrucians came over from Germany, settled in Philadelphia, where you had Kelpius Caves, and then a guy named Conrad Beisel, he detached from that group and came to Ephrata and set up the cloister. Anyway, so like the foundation of the early occult esoteric America actually is based right in the town I generally, you know, I was born in Allentown, but I grew up in Ephrata.
Dude.
So I got to get on.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because, you know, I know you feel like, oh, that's a tangent. That connects right in the skull and bones.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. I'm looking at the time. It's right on time. Let's get into skull and bones, man. Tell me about it.
Let's pivot. So you just mentioned Ephrata Cloister, and a lot of this research started with me 10 years ago when I was in college. I was in New Haven at the Gateway Community College. It's right next to Yale. And I only spent a year and a half there. I dropped out because I realized I was not going to get my money's worth from my degree, yada, yada. But then around that time, I realized, okay, I can, you know, be a self-starter. I can manage my life. I don't need a degree. I could just keep working and figure something out. You know, I didn't know how, I didn't know what I was going to do, but I had that inspiration. And it was partly because of the way life had unfolded while I was in college. Because I went to college wanting to learn about what I was interested in. I only had two classes in college that really satisfied that. But what I did find was a friend in New Haven, and that was a man named Amos. And he told me about Geronimo, whose skull was taken out of his grave in the early 1900s, before World War I, by a man named Prescott Bush, who's the grandfather of the most recent President Bush. And this, you know, Native American icon, hero, you know, Geronimo, was desecrated. His bones were taken from his resting place and brought to this tomb in New Haven. And when Amos told me that, with like the sincerity in his voice and in his eyes, and he looked at me, this little, you know, I'm pretty tall. He was this short, squat, tough Native American dude, you know, looked kind of dressed like a cholo and was, you know, essentially homeless. I didn't know his whole situation at the time, but at that time he was homeless. So I'm striking up friends with the odd, you know, the oddball, like complete opposite. I'm like a little nerd, you know, I just got out of high school. I'm ready to start the world. And the first person I strike up a friend with is this guy who just got out of jail, moved from Arizona to Connecticut, and is telling me about this skull in the tomb. And I'm like, my mind is blown, because I'm interested in all this stuff. I'm like, oh, wow, okay, yeah, tell me more. So Amos, you know, he becomes my friend, and we start meeting up every week, you know, smoke a joint and talk about this kind of stuff. And that became like addicting, you know, this information. I wanted to learn more information like that. And I realized it wasn't easy to come by. You got to find it. You got to really find it. One thing led to another. 6 years later, I find Michael Wan, who, you know, Michael Wan is from your same neck of the woods.
Yeah, I've had him on my show before. Yeah, talking about the Susquehanna alchemy or something like that, right?
Exactly, exactly. And I found Mike's work, and I thought, wow, this is fascinating. You know, this Susquehanna River sounds very interesting. And, you know, 3 or 4 years later, to make a long story short, I realized that all these things are sort of connected, right? And, you know, I endeavored to figure out what was going on at Yale. Yale's part of the Ivy League. The Ivy League was set up by Rosicrucians. And I didn't know that. I didn't realize that. But I started to put it together. And there's a guy named Samuel Hartlieb who created basically like the precursor to the Rosicrucians. It was this sort of secret circle of intellectuals. And their goal was to create a universal school and sort of raise the intelligence of the masses to this level where they would have like a utopia of intelligence, you know, this sort of perfect world. And keep in mind, these are people who had just saw the horrors of the Roman Catholic Church in Europe, right? They saw the Inquisitions and the burnings of the witches and all the political things. So, you know, it's a very long, complicated history that I'm not an expert in, but from what I've gleaned, you have these circles of intellectual, religious, clergymen types that they basically create this university format. And that evolves, you know, into the universities in Germany and England, and then Harvard and Yale become schools basically out of Oxford and Cambridge. So Harvard is started by mostly Oxford and Cambridge graduates, and then in turn Yale is started by mostly Harvard graduates. And from the get-go, there is this sort of alchemical Rosicrucian ideal going on within these colleges. That's why they're resurrecting the cultures that taught the mystery schools, right? They start teaching people Greek and Roman. They start bringing the classics back into education, because for a while in Europe, the Bible was all people were taught, unless you were, you know, of a certain class and status and you had access to a library. For the most part, unless you were Jewish, if you're a Christian, you just had the New Testament to read. That was your sort, your reading material, if you even knew how to read. So this was an kind of an incredible thing to bring, you know, people to a school where they could learn more than just from the Bible, right? And Yale started off as a school for ministers, so it was mostly just, you know, religious studies back then. But the idea that you can create this sort of non-denominational school, you know, a school that wasn't sort of requiring you to have a belief in one religion or another. This was a revolutionary thing. Maybe, you know, it existed in Asia, but it hadn't really existed in Europe or obviously America until this time period, the 16, 1700s, when these schools started coming into fruition. And this is where, at least in America, you see a lot of factionalization occur, right? You see a lot of like factions bubbling out of Harvard and Yale that go on to influence American history in some pretty pronounced ways. At first, in good ways. I mean, a lot of the guys at Yale were revolutionaries. The first spy, Nathan Hale, was a Yale graduate. So they have the first spy. There's so many others. I mean, we don't need to necessarily get into the whole American Revolution, but 1776 is just the middle of the war, right? I mean, it's actually just the beginning. The war went from 1775 to 1783. And, you know, back to my point earlier about like a storybook version of history we're given, you know, we're told, oh, the Declaration of Independence was 1776 and the British were defeated sometime after that. They don't give us a specific date because it gets really foggy. It gets really hazy after 1776. Like 1783, the war ends, but then in 1812, another war begins between England and the United States, right? And France was kind of snubbed in a way, because France, keep in mind, France, they were a big part of helping America free themselves from England, right? But then France lost Canada to England. And then, you know, George Washington and some of the more Federalist founding fathers, they're like, yeah, we should probably, you know, still be friends with England because England's like really cool and they have some good plans for the future, you know? And Thomas Jefferson and some of his guys, I think Franklin was probably also in this side, they were kind of like, no, France is, we're cool with France, you know, we like France. And on the outside, you know, it's, they're using words like Federalist or Patriot or Loyalist, but on the inner network, what's really going on is you have the French Freemasons and the British Freemasons vying for who's going to have sort of the control of the puppet strings for this new country.
Oh, interesting. Because, okay.
Because it was never meant to be like a completely independent America. They did a lot to try to, let's say, dampen down the freedoms that were created with the, you know, the Declaration of Independence. And each document that follows the Declaration of Independence is more and more and more restricting up until the point where the federal government is created. So something went on in those 10 or 15 years, a sort of coup, maybe, a sort of false victory. I'm not saying that America isn't an independent country. I mean, it kind of isn't, and that's obvious if you look at our war record, right? You see all the wars we've participated in and the wars that England has participated in. And pretty much since World War II, we've been, you know, fighting right alongside of England in any one of their conflicts. I don't, I think maybe that small one in the Falkland Islands, I don't think we were there for that. But either way, there's a pretty obvious departure from the Declaration of Independence and what America's actually been doing with our military industrial complex, right? I mean, that's a huge thing in the conspiracy community, especially since 9/11, with our rights being taken from us even more through the Patriot Act. So, yeah, and ironically, it's called the Patriot Act. And who was in charge when that happened? Well, none other than Bush, who was a skull and bones man. And I'm going to connect that back to New Haven, because New Haven had a lot of loyalists in town during the Revolutionary War. There was a Tory tavern that got seized by the New Haven government because I think from 1775 to 1781, they were meeting in New Haven trying to, you know, basically plan battles with the British, you know, on their side against the American Patriots. So you have these like interesting little factions of people who, they want to remain loyal to England during the American Revolution, because before the war, they had all sorts of agreements and trade going on, and they had ideals of being, you know, this great colony for England. Mm. And then all of that kind of goes away after the Stamp Act. People start fighting. And here's another, you know, sort of irony. The first patriots in America were the Native Americans. They, in 1676, not 1776, 100 years later, the first Indian War started. And it was called King Philip's War. Now, that's a confusing title in history, because you look at that and you think, who's King Philip? Some Dutch guy? No, he was a Native American named Metacomet.
Oh.
And, yeah, they called him King Philip because they were just, they didn't want to say Metacomet. They maybe they couldn't pronounce it, or they couldn't communicate well enough to know his name at that time. But his name was Metacomet, and he was a Native American who basically said, we're done with this. We're not going to be your slaves. We're not going to be your farmers. We're not going to fight you, you know, for scraps anymore. We're going to get together, and we're going to leave, or we're going to, you're going to leave, you know, basically was the way that it went down, right? Eventually, the English and the French and the Dutch all won, you know. and the Indians and Native Americans left. They weren't totally wiped out. They weren't totally massacred. They just kind of moved west, and that movement west just kept happening all the way up until, you know, the gold rush, right? And so that is very important, because, you know, people think of, you know, Native Americans as sort of just being in the background of American history. They're just sort of like, they're in the way at first. Mm-hmm. And then we clear them out of the way, and there's this land for the Christians, right? Well, the Indian War is the first in this saga of genocides. And this is an American genocide, you know, it's an English genocide. It's a Dutch genocide. It's a French genocide. I mean, really, it's a human genocide. We should just strip all the labels away and see it for what it is. And it's kind of interesting, because we give all this credit to the Patriot, but, you know, again, like I said, Crispus, the first victim of the Boston Massacre, was a Native American. The first Patriots in America were Native Americans. There's this whole saga of history that we're not given, and it's important that we understand it, because I think that if we had a stronger foundation of understanding, we would navigate today's problems differently. Identity politics wouldn't be such a talking point if we understood how together we've always been as an American people. Scots, Irish, Celts, Scandinavians, Native Americans, Asians, Chinese, like all these people once lived in North America without empire, without imperial rule. They lived by trading with one another, by cooperating with one another. And a lot of that's been stripped away from our history. And it's thanks to institutions like Harvard and Yale. Yale started the first Indian missionary school. It was called the Stockbridge School. And they essentially said, you either become Christian or you die, right?
Oh, wow.
And that was how it went. You know, people who went to this school, they became a missionary for the Christians, and then they would be sent further west to help Christianize other tribes. And that started with the founders of Yale. And, you know, missionaries are essentially like spies in a way. You know, they gather information for the power structure.
Oh, interesting. That makes me think about the LDS Mormons out here in Utah. It's a huge operation. They send missionaries all over the world all the time. And you know, I understand the idea is just spreading the, you know, the gospel or whatever, but that's it. Because of their occult background, which ties into intelligence agencies. You know, Richard Spence, who he was on your show, he's big into that stuff.
Well, and the thing that people like, you know, they think about history in this sort of, okay, so the Indians were here, and then they all died of diseases, and then, you know, the Christians kind of came through and took over. It's really not even close to that at all. I mean, you're mentioning LDS. They're a huge part of this story. They come in out of Freemasonry and the Great Awakening, this religious revival that took place in the early 1800s, late 1700s, where people were like swept with this religious fervor, while at the same time others were kind of starting this intellectualism, this like atheism was being born. Because you at the same time you have these people who are like radically like throwing themselves into the arms of Jesus, like in public, like, you know, I'm taken by the Spirit of the Lord, these big public displays. At the same time, you have people who are like, you know, mixing potions together and for God. Like, it's alchemy, but it's for God. They believe that, all right, God's inspiring me to mix these things to create a medicine. And all of these, like, you know, it was very crude what was going on. But it evolved into what Harvard and Yale do now with their medicine program, right? I mean, back then they were mixing like antimony and silver and who knows what kind of herbs. Nowadays they take those herbs and they, you know, turn them into microparticles, reorganize them, and then put them in little capsules and sell them to people, right? I mean, it's essentially alchemy in a modern form. So, you know, what am I saying here? I kind of just jumped all over the place. I went from Indian Wars to alchemy.
Oh, fascinating, but, yeah.
But why is it all connected, and what does it have to do with the Mormons? I mean, the Mormons are kind of connected to this too. It's because the idea was for people, and the Mormons kind of picked this ideology up and, you know, integrated it into their religion. But the idea was that America was this place that God had preserved. He had saved it from the rest of the world up until this time, this special time that they were in, you know, in the 1600s, 1700s. This was their belief, that they were in this special time and that God's judgment was coming very soon, and Europe and the rest of the world was going to be destroyed. And the fact that they came to North America, it was like a sign from God that, okay, you will be saved from this destruction that's coming for the rest of the world.
Oh, interesting. Okay, yeah, they talk about how they think that either Jesus or Jesus and his disciples came to America during, I don't know, after his resurrection or something like that, and traveled around.
Yeah, this was an idea that actually one of the founding fathers helped popularize. His name was Elias Boudinot, and he believed that all the Native Americans were part of the lost tribes of Israel. And that idea got infused into Mormonism, because what did Joseph Smith find? He went and found the magical tabernacle, and he found the golden books that, you know, like, they're basically looking for ancient religious relics. That's what they're talking about with the Mormons, is they found some ancient religious relics here in America. And the Mormons weren't the only people looking for that. The Freemasons, the Rosicrucians, I mean, they all had heard stories probably from Bristol, England, of the Welsh King Madoc, or Prince Madoc, who was the nephew or son of King Arthur II. So, like, not mythical King Arthur, but his son. So wow. If King Arthur was real, which he might have been real, then he had a son who sent a nephew to America in the 1100s, way before Columbus. And they might have hid some things here. You know, Dr. Joseph Farrell, who I just talked to, he says the Templars may have come here and hid some gold, or maybe even the treasure was just here, and they were keeping it a secret from the rest of the world up until Columbus, right?
Right. And there's that show on History Channel, The Secret of Oak Island. I think they're looking for Knights Templar treasures or something, aren't they?
Right. Oh, well, that's got up in Canada, and that would be the Northern Passage, where the Templars would have come over the Atlantic. So you have the Southern Passage that goes from about the midpoint of Africa into the Caribbean. It's this current that goes across the Atlantic Ocean. And they have the same thing going on in the north, right along the, you know, Iceland, Greenland, across the Atlantic to the coast of Europe, and, you know, back across to the coast of Canada. There is an argument, again, to be made that all of this information about the New World was known by the Vatican. It was known by the universities. People in Cambridge and Oxford knew about it. And Francis Bacon wrote about New Atlantis and his plan for utopia in the New World. And it seems to me like Harvard and Yale are fulfilling those prophecies. They're fulfilling that idea of destiny. And Skull and Bones, okay, has infiltrated Yale as a German Illuminati organization in order to take whatever Yale was doing and maybe refractionalize it back into the control of the Vatican and the control of the old world, maybe like the Black Nobility, right? This group of people that secretly rules the Vatican or controls the Vatican, the Roman power source, right? I mean, that, it seems to me, is what's going on with Skull and Bones. And that's like, you know, I just gave you like a zoomed out perspective. Like, we just zoomed out from the details. And if you were to ask me, like, well, Mark, what's the big story here? That's it. Skull and Bones They left Germany with these basically Illuminati ideologies, infiltrated America. George Washington admits it. He's like, yeah, the Illuminati's here. I actually helped them get here. I don't think he said that exactly, but it was pretty much that explicit. Like, yeah, the Illuminati's here, and I'm happy they are. Because what we're seeing are factions behind the scenes, the War of the Foxes, right? These secret societies that are battling each other for control, but they're doing it in a way where the masses, the general public, have no idea this war is even going on. In fact, us, the public, we're fighting other wars for them. We think these wars are for one purpose, when really it's for these secret reasons, this secret agenda. And now all of this stuff is becoming much more obvious to people, right? Like, you know, nowadays we have guys like William Cooper and David Icke, who we mentioned already, but so many others, somebody else, Jordan Maxwell, you know, like people in the past 50, 60, 70 years, we're catching on, you know, right. We're using this sort of deduction to figure out what's really going on. And I think if we take that mindset into the past, we're going to find even crazier things
You're making a lot of sense. You're making a lot of sense right now. I'm on the fence about a lot of conspiracy ideas, but one thing I wholeheartedly believe in is that things don't add up. You know, the mainstream narrative of history, present day things, and we're not alone, right? The idea of people getting interested in conspiracy theories over time, it's kind of increased recently. And from what I've read, it goes in cycles over over our history. But this is a fascinating subject. Now you've got a full episode on this, right? On New Haven and Skull and Bones, that's out.
Yeah. So the plan is actually to create a it's going to be like a series. All right. Okay. I'm going to release the first episode on the 22nd of this month, because Skull and Bones, of course, their famous number is 322. So we're actually going to be in a palindrome that day because it's 322/20/23. So that's 322 twice, well, forward and backwards. So I'm going to release the first episode of a new series. It's going to be available at first only on my Patreon. Eventually, it will be released to the free feed. But the first episode, the trailer, will go out on next Wednesday. And it's essentially going to take people through the history of Skull and Bones and Yale. I'm going to start with Francis Bacon and his plan for the New World, this New Atlantis, and basically take people through the history and show how that actually took place, like how their plan for New Atlantis unfolded. And we're in it right now. This is Atlantis. I mean, they call it America, but you know, it might as well be Atlantis the way they write about it, especially the further back you go. You know, guys like George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, they weren't just interested in this stuff. They lived it. You know, like they lived this life of being a part of a secret society, and I think they lived it to an extent that we really haven't begun to understand, because as Americans, we're still sort of caught up in the propaganda of who these people were. And yeah, hopefully this history will reveal to people that American history is a lot more complicated and less black and white or less red and blue than we think. You know, it's a whole, you know, pastiche of mixed colors and strange histories that are, unraveled and then retangled together here on this continent.
Interesting. Okay, so there you go. March 22nd is the beginning of the journey there. It's a fitting day. Now, before I let you go, I have a thing I've been trying out on a new guest here. 5 rapid fire questions. You don't need to elaborate. You don't need to defend.
Cool.
You can be as short or long-winded as you want, but 5 rapid fires, okay? Do you like Tom Hanks?
No.
What was your red pill moment? Do you have one?
9/11. All right. I was only 7 years old, by the way.
Dang, man. All right. Well, what's one conspiracy you 100% believe in?
Sasquatch.
All right. What's one conspiracy that you 100% don't believe in?
Secret space program.
Oh, wow. Okay, man. I'll have to talk to you about that one.
To be fair, Corey Good's secret space program.
Oh, okay.
Corey Good says about the secret space
controversial
program. There are better opinions on there. Go ahead.
All right. Next question. All right. That's a good elaboration there. Yeah. He's a controversial character. Last one. How does one, you know, I like to use this as an example for the listeners. And so if you have one that you do, tell me, but how do you unplug and keep yourself from going black pill and just being too deep in the weeds and being negative and distrusting everybody and everything?
Well, it's funny you said keep yourself too deep in the weeds. There's no such thing. I'm high all the time, brother. I'm deep in the weed, and that's how I stay floating. I honestly think cannabis, I'm kind of like an advocate because, you know, cannabis, people think it makes you dumb. I think the opposite. I think it makes me smarter. I'm not recommending other people try it for the same results, but whatever my chemistry is, it works for me, man. And yeah. I'm constantly moving towards the truth. You know, even if it's a little dark, I think it's worth knowing, you know,
that's good, man.
Luckily, yeah,
I support that.
Like, thank you. We have brave folks like yourself who paved this way for guys like me. I mean, you're a trailblazer compared to me. Like, I look at the books you've written and I say, damn, I want to do that. You know, I want to do that for myself.
Right on,
I want to be a self-starter. So thank you for the inspiration that you've molded, you know, you've crafted like this place for yourself. And that's a big deal to a guy like me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, dude, that's too kind. Thank you.
Being inspired. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, man. Yeah. And it sounds like you're the next wave of, guys trying to spread the truth. So, man, keep it up. You're kicking ass right now. Last thing, and I'll post these links in the show notes, but how can our audience connect with you, get your podcast, sign up for your Patreon, all that stuff?
Everything is at myfamilythinksimcrazy.com. Just go there, whether you're on desktop or mobile. The website works great with both, and all of my links are there. Instagram has a link tree, so you can get that link in the bio on the Instagram, and it's all My Family Thinks I'm Crazy. Wherever you look, YouTube, anywhere, it's My Family Thinks I'm Crazy.
All right, there you go. All right, everybody, go support my man. Check out his Esoteric America, My Family Thinks I'm Crazy. I mean, you've got a full catalog of stuff to catch up on. I'm definitely going to be checking out the Skull and Bone stuff. I'm very curious about 322. So,
and if you're ever in New Haven, come on down. I'll give you a tour, brother. You know,
yeah.
A lot of weird stuff to see in the streets. That goes for you and your audience. They can hit me up, and they're in town. I'd be happy to give them a tour. I give tours all the time.
Oh, that's dope. Yeah, definitely. I'll definitely hit you next time I get up to that realm. I haven't been north of New York City ever, so.
Oh.
But I'm planning on going to Boston here someday, so that's close, right?
Yeah. We're right in between.
Okay, right on. Cool, brother. All right. Well, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Isaac.
So there you go. Fascinating talk. If you want more, and I know you do, because Mark's got a ton of great guests. You wouldn't believe it. Check out his podcast. Go to myfamilythinksimcrazy.com. You can get the link to his podcast, self-titled, from the website there, as well as Esoteric America podcast. I'm going to get on there someday. You know, we talked about that a little bit with the occult roots of PA. We're going to do a show someday. So be sure to follow Mark and all of his good work. And I want to give you an update on my Apple Premium feed progress. I'm going through and painstakingly marking every single episode, almost 500 episodes here. I got to tag them with their season number and episode number. Each season is going to be the new year. So, for example, we started in 2014. That's season one. So I got to go through and index all those, upload all the bonus non-commercial versions. We're getting there, folks. We're getting there. So hang in there. I'm going to enable the Apple Premium option. And I think it's got to come out to about $7 because Apple takes like half of what you make. Jerks. So I'm going to enable that someday soon here for people who don't want to sign up for Patreon and all that stuff. But, you know, you can just go to patreon.com/IlluminatiWatcher right now and get all the stuff. But yeah, that's the progress. I'll get it done here soon. Till next time, stay woke.